You're listening to the Co-Main Event Podcast. And now your hosts, Ben Folks and Chad Dundas.
That's right. You're listening to another episode of the Co-Main Event Mixed Martial Arts Podcast. I'm Chad Dundas. That's Ben Folks. We're both longtime MMA journalists, and for the last 10 years, we've been meeting here every week to break down all the action in the wild, weird, and occasionally wonderful world of mixed martial arts. Ben, as we sit here to record this episode of the CME proper, it is actually Friday. I am going to be gone next week on the road with my family, going down to Colorado to see my wife's family a little bit there. So we won't be around to preview UFC 277. We didn't want to leave the people hanging, so we thought that we would go ahead and record this episode of The Proper on Friday. And obviously that is a slippery slope, my guy. It's a little bit of a leap of faith here. We're throwing up prayers to the big guy upstairs that he can hold together this UFC 277 card by, you know, by all we know, by the time people hear this on Monday, terrible tragedy could have befallen this card. Everyone could have missed weight. Who knows? Some people could have eaten some bad tiramisu, and all of a sudden we're staring down, Derek Lewis versus Kai Kara France in a mixed weight fight as the main event of UFC 277. But here we are. We're going to do it anyway.
See, I was all set to try to just act like we were recording this on Monday, and I was just going to be like, oof, how about that main event at UFC London? Wow. That was either exactly what we are expected or the opposite of that, right, guys? Like, I felt like we could have soundboarded our way through this one.
We could have punched it in and been like, what a terrific win for Tom Aspinall.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, once we developed the technology to do that, man, we're on easy street, brother.
I really did not expect Curtis Blaydes to win via Peruvian necktie.
Yeah, see, we need to start working smart instead of working hard. You know what I mean?
That's true. That is true. But here we are as babes in the woods. We're just going to talk about UFC 277. We're going to dispense with our normal three-round format. We're just going to do sort of a free-form conversation this week where we look at some of the top fights coming up on this pay-per-view that's going down at the American Airlines Center in Dallas, Texas, coming up on Saturday, July 30th. So if ever there was a way to wave a flag to the MMA gods telling them to come in and just wreak havoc on a scheduled UFC pay-per-view card, I think us recording this episode a few days early, that's it. That's the surefire way to have someone trip on some junk in the back and blow out their knee.
Yeah, that's the way that the city of London bans MMA in the hours before fight time. And it's all our fault.
All right.
You know what? We thought it over. Fuck this human cockfighting bullshit. Not going to happen.
Reminder, you're listening to the Co-Main Event Podcast Proper. Don't forget to go out and follow us on Instagram at CME If You Nasty. You can also like us over on Facebook at facebook.com/co-main-event. This show drops every Monday afternoon for free in your timelines and your podcast libraries. And if you think we're having fun over here, you got to go check us out over on Patreon. We're there all week generally at patreon.com/co-main-event. Not this week because I'm out. We do have some fun stuff planned coming up on Wednesday. I believe we're going to have an interview with our guy Richard Fifield about his involvement with the Territories, the new professional wrestling fiction project that Ben and I both have stories in. Richard also has a good story in there. We talked to him last week. I think that's going to drop on Wednesday specifically and exclusively for the beloved patrons of the co-main event. So if you want to check that out and all our usual programmed content over there on the Patreon, we got the Wednesday live chat, Thursday doing the damn thing, and the Friday power hour. All you got to do is head over to patreon.com/co-main-event and check us out. We got three handy tiers of patronage. You can get in for as low as $1 a month and start getting the content over there.
Killer content.
Absolutely killer content. No rounds this week. No music this week. A bit of a stripped down affair. We won't have Are You Fucking Kidding Me? We won't have Just Saying Stuff, but what we will have like we always do about this time, is a little bit of listener mail.
Listener mail.
This week's listener mail is once again brought to you by Fulton and Rourke. As many of you already know, the CME and Fulton and Rourke have a relationship that goes back literally years. These are products and, frankly, people that we can personally vouch for. I use Fulton and Rourke grooming products every day right now as we record this. I'm wearing Fulton and Rourke deodorant. And a little while ago, when I took my morning shower, I used Fulton and Rourke body wash and shampoo 2-in-1 combo. I used the Fulton and Rourke face wash. I'm not messing with you. I'm not lying. These products are great. I love them. I use them every day. I also know that there are a bunch of the little co-maniacs out there listening to the sound of my voice right now who over the years have almost bought stuff from Fulton and Rourke. You hear us talking about it every week. Maybe you check out the website. You have the promo code all loaded up, and then you don't pull the trigger. And look, I get it, man. It can feel risky to buy stuff off the internet. You know, fragrance, bar soap, whatever it is, anything that you haven't used before. And you don't know whether or not you should take the plunge just because your favorite podcast host keeps saying you should do it. But that's why Fulton and Rourke has created their 30-day no questions asked return policy. If a customer buys something and doesn't love it, they can just send it back. And the people at Fulton and Rourke will happily refund or exchange them for their purchase, whichever they prefer. Fulton and Rourke has had this offer in effect for something like 7 years now. And let me tell you, they don't get many returns, but when they do, the customer service team is great. We're talking about actual people here whose names we know, Mary and May Lynn. They're smart. They're nice. They're really helpful if you ever need them. If a customer ever has a problem, Fulton and Rourke have real people standing by to help them out. So if you've been thinking about buying something, why not do it? If you don't love it, at worst, you're out a couple of bucks to send it back. Tons of cool stuff going on over at Fulton and Rourke. If you want to check it out for yourself, CME listeners, as always, can save 15% on their first purchase with the coupon code IFYOUNASTY. Again, that's the coupon code IFYOUNASTY over at Fulton and Rourke. First piece of listener mail this week comes to us from Scott, who writes, do you ever sometimes have a galaxy brain thought like, why don't UFC fighters get a cut of the live gate? Like, what about 12%, 10%, 5%? Sometimes my head pops out of the MMA bubble where we all are, and I have these strange ideas, like the company not getting 100% of all the gate money. Anyways, I'm sure the sold-out London event will be great this weekend. The gate money at this point is such a small fraction of what the UFC brings in revenue-wise, and I feel like the Co-Main Event podcast editorial position is that we are on the record pretty consistently saying fighters should probably get 50% of all revenue, regardless of what it comes from, whether that be merchandise, whether it be concessions, whether it be pay-per-view buys, whether it be live gate. But at this point, live gate, as we found out during the pandemic, I'm sure that the UFC took a financial hit for not having that live gate, but they were able to, you know, have their most profitable years in history as they kept trumpeting during the pandemic. So in answer to Scott's question, yes, I'm all in favor of MMA fighters, UFC fighters getting a chunk of this live gate, preferably 50%. And it's hard not to notice, you know, when Dana White, I think, is maybe legally required to show up at the press conference and say what the live gate was, depending on what state they're in there. But, you know, when he shows up and says that the gate is however millions of dollars. Yeah, man, if I was a UFC fighter, I'd probably be like, where's that money going? Can I get a little chunk of that? Uncle Dana, yeah, you want to give me a birthday present with a brick full of cash in it from the live gate?
And it's worth saying that when we talk about how, yeah, probably the live gate is a small percentage of what the UFC's overall earnings, since they make so much money through ESPN Plus and TV rights deals all over the place. You know, that's the big stuff. But like UFC 276, last big pay-per-view there in the T-Mobile Arena, the official gate for that one was about 10.5 mil. Okay. So that's not nothing.
Yeah.
You know?
I would go ahead and hazard a guess that 50% of that is probably more than the entire UFC payroll was for that event. Fighter payroll.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, they're not all like that. Like, if you look at UFC 273, which did down there at ViStar Veterans Memorial Arena in Jacksonville, it was $3.5 million. But still, like, it is interesting that sometimes when you sort of step back and look at the bigger picture and you think, man, all these things that fighters have just gotten used to, like, well, of course you can't just wear whatever sponsors you want on your shorts, man. That's not how this shit works. Of course you don't get a piece of the live gate, you guys. That's it. We're the ones putting on the event. And it's just kind of been normalized in everybody's mind, and this is just how it works. And so then when you are fighting for a bigger share of the stuff, you're not even thinking about how big the actual pie really is. Like, they have conditioned you to not even think about the possibility that you should be entitled to some of that money, you know?
Especially at the live gate, where you're right, the UFC is putting on the show, but be a pretty lonely, empty, boring show without the fighters. Since that is the reason everybody shows up there. Also, have you looked at the ticket prices recently on what it costs to go to a live UFC event?
Yeah, especially a good one.
Costs a lot of money. Costs a lot of money to go to those events. So maybe these record gates are not totally a coinkydink. Maybe that's part of the plan, you might say. Yes, UFC fighters should get a cut of revenue, all revenue. And live gate should be no exception. Next question this week comes to us from Jart Harley Barvis, who writes, okay. I'm sure you have no shortage of emails about the absolute crackerjack between Matt Schnell and Sue Mujarji. But I think I can offer a fresh angle beyond just gushing about it. I pose to you a question that a friend of mine asked me after the fight. Do you think this fight ends up in the fight wing of the UFC Hall of Fame? My instinct tells me no, that it won't, but should it? Thus far, outside of Hughes Trigg 2, the Hall of Fame fight formula seems to be 3 to 5 rounds of back and forth wars of attrition. But shouldn't there also be a place for this fight and fights like Arlovsky versus Brown and Barry versus Congo? Furthermore, will the Hall of Fame eligibility of a fight like Saturday's hinge on Matt Schnell sticking around and becoming a long-term quote-unquote guy for the UFC a la Cub Swanson? Or should fights be able to make it based solely on the merits of the bell-to-bell action discourse, if you will?
Yeah, see, that's what I was going to say if you start talking about this, is if Matt Schnell bounces out of the UFC in a couple fights and ends up in Bellator, then the odds of this making it into the fight wing anytime soon go way, way down. That's not an accident that they're looking at, you know, they want to have a tie to somebody who they feel like is clearly a UFC guy and not just some guys who showed up, were awesome one night, and then shortly thereafter spun away from the UFC's orbit. Yeah. And for one reason or another. And that, again, is kind of the problem with having a Hall of Fame that is just run by the company at the whims of the company, because it's not like there's any sort of system for deciding this where we're doing it on the merits of what you actually did. It's just kind of like, how do we feel about you at the time? And the boss just gets to say yay or nay.
Yeah. You know, the idea of having a pioneer wing and a fight wing in the UFC Hall of Fame, it's cool and I like it, but it also seems like kind of a bald-faced play to just have more stuff that you can have in the Hall of Fame, like an acknowledgement that, like, hey, man, this thing has only been around since 93. We literally don't have enough people to just have the Hall of Fame be the all-time greats of the UFC. If we're going to come and do an induction ceremony every single year, we just flat need more content to be putting in there. So that's why we're doing the fight wing. And I think it's a cool addition and I'm kind of glad they're doing it. But at the same time, it already seems like sort of an add-on to me. And this fight, Matt Schnell versus Sue Mujarji, was terrific. One of the better comebacks that we've seen in a long time in the UFC. But at the same time, like the UFC's gamble right now is that for all these fight night events, they're just going to take a handful of fighters, match them up in a handful of fights, shake them up in a Crown Royal bag and dump them out on the table. And one of them or a couple of them are going to be great fights. Like, that's the whole gamble of the UFC business model right now. So this is a great one. But will we even be talking about this fight 6 weeks from now or a year from now, let alone like 5 years from now or whenever you would start thinking about putting it in the hall?
Yeah, I mean, I understand too the purpose that the fights wing serves. Because we've talked before about what kind of Hall of Fame do you want to have? Do you want to have the Hall of Fame where it's just, here are the true greats of the sport, you know, champions, dominant long-term champions who are really titans of their time in the sport? Or do you want to have kind of an awesome guy Hall of Fame where you're like, here are the people who are really great, but here are also some dudes who are awesome, like Cub Swanson, you know, didn't become like a champion, really dominated a division, but was an awesome dude over a long period of time. And the fight swing is a good way to get some of those people technically in the Hall of Fame, to recognize them, to have them have a presence there without getting into the question of like, what do we really mean? What does it mean to be a UFC Hall of Famer? And it's also, you're right, that if we want to do these ceremonies, we want to have one every summer and have a few things that we're doing at them, we're going to run out of guys. We're already like turning right around after somebody's retirement and inducting them when, who knows, they might still come out of retirement and fight some more. So to have just more stuff that we can talk about and put in there is good for them. I think that it, like, when I went to the Boxing Hall of Fame when I was in upstate New York, I was struck by how, you know, not exactly extensive it is. And it's been around a whole lot longer as a sport. And so this is a way to just sort of I like the idea of having these different wings, right? Like the contributor wing, the like non-fighter kind of wing. Like stuff like that is honestly a good way to show like there's more that goes into this sport than just the guys fighting. We want to have a separate place for the dudes who were just truly the absolute top of their field and the dudes who were rad one night. You know, but it would be nice if we didn't have to sit around and wonder like, but like, do you have to still be on semi-good terms somehow with the company in order for them to recognize that you were rad one night?
Yeah. You're telling me if he later changes his official nickname to Bellator Matt Schnell, he's probably not.
That does have a ring to it, honestly.
Yeah. PFL Matt Schnell. Oh, that actually rhymes.
Oh, shit.
Holy shit.
Oh, shit.
Here, we stumbled onto some magic here, unknowingly.
Get his agent on the phone right now.
Next question this week comes to us from Derby Dave, who writes, what in the world is the UFC doing with Sean O'Malley and Peter Yan? Is this like the Greg Hardy thing when they put a bunch of time and money into a guy, only decide he wasn't actually that good and immediately flush him down the toilet? I seriously don't understand what the thinking could be here, loading O'Malley up against the fairly dominant former champion sort of out of the blue. Discourse? Now, we should point out, Ben, this fight is not officially made, but it has been reported, and generally these reports turn out to be correct. I think
Sean O'Malley's talking like it's basically made.
Yeah, that's also true. Scheduled for UFC 280 in Abu Dhabi, where the UFC more and more likes to load up with Russian talent. And now you got Peter Yan looking for a comeback fight after losing the title to, or losing his chance to regain the title, excuse me, against Aljamain Sterling in his recent appearance. Now he's getting Sean O'Malley, who comes in off this potential fight that he had to get a win over a ranked opponent against Pedro Munhoz at UFC 276, which of course ended in the no contest after the eye poke. And this does seem real weird in terms of matchmaking, just a giant, an absolutely huge leap forward in terms of competition for Sean O'Malley. And obviously were he to win it, it would be an enormous signpost in his career, an enormous turning point for him. But it's kind of hard to imagine him winning it, is it not?
Yeah, it is. And it tells you something that the sort of immediate response from the MMA community is, oh no, what did Sean O'Malley do? Well, they're trying to fuck around and get Sean O'Malley pieced up. I mean, this theory that it's sort of the Greg Hardy, hey, we put a bunch of resources into promoting this guy, and now we're going to find out if he's good or not, and either way, we're ready for an answer. That, there might be something to that. Because otherwise, it's hard to think, how do you poke a guy in the eye and then get a much bigger fight as a result?
Yeah.
Like, it's difficult if you think of it as a reward, as if, okay, we liked what we saw in your last outing and we've decided you're ready for a giant step up, the yeah. next level of competition. It's hard to imagine that that's really the case. Unless, you know, it's the UFC sort of looking at it and being like, okay, maybe we think we've decided we got whatever pop we're going to get out of O'Malley kind of, or it, whatever pop we're going to get will continue if he's the kind of guy where he doesn't need to win them all and people just like having him around. But, you know, maybe we get a little bit of that shine to rub off on Peter Yan, who we think might have some real staying power in the division, but, you know, could use a win over somebody who brings a few eyeballs to him when he's not in a title fight. I don't know. Maybe it's something like that. Or maybe we just said, you know what, fuck it. We're done thinking of good ideas for this guy. just throw him in there. See what happens to him.
It feels, as you know, you just said a reward would be weird way to think of this. It feels like the opposite of a reward, man. It feels like a punishment or something. Like they're tired of waiting for him. They are sick of the antics of him doing the fadeaway jump shot and celebrating like he won the championship when he wins or doesn't even win. It causes a fight to be declared a no contest due to an eye poke. There is something real strange about it that I can't quite figure out exactly what is going on. When we talked about this last Friday on the Power Hour over on the Patreon page, you floated the idea and I couldn't quite tell if how serious this is or if it's, you know, more of a joke, but like that, you know, O'Malley is one of these guys who occasionally makes noise about the contract. He wants to get paid more. He wants to fight out his contract, et cetera, et cetera. We recently saw after a long contract dispute with the UFC, Nate Diaz finally comes to terms on the fight we didn't think he was going to take against Khamzat Chimaev, which is a very, very tough matchup for him. Is it possible that this is, you know, we're sending a message here that like, oh, hey, you want to talk about your contract? You want to talk about how you deserve more money and all this other stuff? All right, here's a fight against Peter Yan, or here's a fight against Khamzat Chimaev. Now who wants to talk about their contract? That would be, I mean, that's some, we got the tinfoil hats on for this one. That would be some fairly bloodthirsty negotiating tactics, but also, yeah, like, I guess you can't kind of totally put that stuff past the UFC.
Yeah, but I honestly, though, think that if you were trying to send a message to fighters, that would be an ineffective way to do it. Because I don't think other fighters look at it, or at least when it was, if it was them, I don't think they would look at it and be like, oh no, they're fucking around. They're punishing me by giving me this super good guy who was a champion recently. Like, I think that they would look at it and be like, yes, this is the opportunity I needed to prove myself. It's about goddamn time. I mean, Sean O'Malley has talked about how he wants the easiest fight for the most money, that kind of shit. And this is definitely not that. But don't you think most fighters, it would be hard for them to view it as, oh, you get punished by getting this big fight that where people think you're probably going to lose? Because that's a big opportunity for them. And they all think they're going to win.
They think that about themselves.
Yes. See, that's what I'm saying. It's like, that's why I don't think it would be an effective way to send a message to them. Be like, oh yeah, you want to talk some shit? We'll put you up against this former champion who everybody thinks is going to crush you. Because they already always think, everybody's against me. Powerful forces are aligned against me. The promoter wants the other guy to win. They think that about every fucking fight. But you're putting me in big fights. That's kind of what they want. I think that they would not see that as a real... Like, they would see, we're not going to give you any fight. We're going to find a way to keep you on the sideline and making no money and people forgetting your name. Like, they would see that as a much scarier punishment than we'll give you a big-ass, tough-ass fight.
Yeah, they think that about themselves, but I can guarantee you that there's a bunch of UFC fighters out there when they find out Sean O'Malley is going to fight Peter Yan, that they make the face of the guy from the Red Solo Cup gif, you know, the one I'm talking about?
Yes.
Yeah. And the guy's just like, ooh, he like turns and walks away. That's everybody in the UFC is making that face when they find out about Sean O'Malley versus Peter Yan.
I don't know about that. That's what they're saying right now.
Yeah. We got a couple other questions here, neither of which are MMA related. This one came in from Matt, who writes, I recently listened to a Planet Money podcast on sell-by, use-by dates on food and learned that Montana, where we live, has the strictest sell-by requirements for milk in the country at 12 days. Apparently, this is an antiquated requirement from the 80s and doesn't consider modern pasteurization capabilities. Pasteurized milk is good for 24 days when stored at 44 degrees Fahrenheit and 30 days when stored at 41 degrees Fahrenheit. I immediately thought, who do I know in Montana that could benefit from this information? Unfortunately, no one. But after listening to the CME for years now, I feel like I know you guys, so I had to reach out to share this potential milk arbitrage. If you're looking for an additional revenue stream, aside from your windfall of gambling profits, just load up some of that quote-unquote expired milk at Albertsons, free, of course, since they can't use it, and haul it across state lines to Idaho, which seems to be the Wild West of milk. No sell-by date required. Raw milk? Of course. What do you think? Is this the marketing opportunity that the CME has been waiting for? Loading up some expired milk and driving it over to Coeur d'Alene to sell it on the black market?
Okay, so basically we're going to become milk runners?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. You know what?
Milk-leggers.
I'm very interested in this whole concept. First of all, pasteurized milk is good for 24 days when stored at 44 degrees Fahrenheit and 30 days when stored at 41 degrees Fahrenheit. I mean, that's information I can use. Information everybody can use here on the CME podcast, even if it comes basically courtesy of another more serious podcast. But I tell you what, when you have two small children, one of whom basically lives on cereal year round, one of whom is like 90% cereal.
Yeah.
In her just body composition. Brother, how long can a carton of milk be stored in my fridge is not a problem that I face. That shit goes quick around here. You know? Way quicker when grandma comes to visit and is buying people Fruit Loops. Like it ain't no thing. So, not that important for my life at this current stage. Still good to know. And I wonder... You know, now I'm just picturing me rolling up into like an Albertsons here in Missoula and be like, so I notice your milk has passed this point of the sell-by date. Give it to me. fuck you, give it to me. You can't do anything with it. I know my rights. God damn it. Give me this milk. You know, I'm curious how that would go.
That's the hardest part of this whole thing for me to believe, that they're just letting you walk out the door of the local grocery stores with as much free milk as you want because it has reached the expiration date. That's the hardest thing. I totally believe that Montana would have had a set it and forget it policy when it came to how we're going to legislate and use our milk. That like back in the 80s, they're like, oh, we already passed a law about that. We might as well just leave it for the next 100 years.
You're saying you think maybe our legislature that meets every other year does not have this on their books as a priority to go back and look at our milk legislation?
Yeah, the legislature that meets every other year and all the citizens are like, you know what? Let's keep those crazy motherfuckers at home as long as we can. We don't need them meeting every year. Let's just
until the milk runners start making a splash and then the legislature, the Muppets in the legislature will be like, we got to do something about these guys. They must be stopped.
The Muppets in the legislature. You've been watching online videos.
The guy in the bin.
You know, you can say what you want to about the co-main event podcast, but I guarantee we're the only MMA podcast this week to get one question from a guy referring to himself as Derby Dave about whether or not the UFC is sick of Sean O'Malley's shit and is basically trying to light him on fire. And then an immediate follow-up question about milk.
Yeah. How many other MMA podcasts out there use the phrase milk arbitrage this week?
That is going to do it for listener mail. If you have a question, comment, or concern that you would like to air to the podcast in future weeks, you know how to do it. You go to our website, comainevent.com, and click the link in the top right-hand corner of the screen that says email the podcast. That'll get you in touch with us. Is it about fighting? Is it about milk? We don't care. Send it in. Chances are we'll probably read it. Remember, this week the CME podcast is brought to you in part by our friends at BetterHelp. How well would you take care of a car if you had to keep the same one for your entire life? That's how our brains work. So why don't we treat them the same way? How we care for our minds affects how we experience life, so it's important to invest time and care into keeping them healthy. Last week, I told you about my own experiences using BetterHelp for some personalized one-on-one therapy sessions early on during the pandemic. It was great for me. It helped me out a lot. Got my anxiety under control. Ben, I know you've been doing some similar stuff with therapy. Tell the kids at home how it's helped you.
Yeah, well, longtime listeners of this podcast will probably not be surprised to hear that your boy battles depression on a semi-regular basis, and if he is not careful about staying on top of that, he can spiral down into a deep, dark hole from which it is difficult to climb up out of. And so one of the hard parts about getting to a point where I felt like, you know what, I don't think I'm doing so great and I could benefit from talking to somebody is then where do you start and where do you go from there? And I had to basically just look around on the internet and kind of cold call people and be like, I don't think I'm doing great. Can I talk to your therapist about it? And so something like BetterHelp gives you an opportunity to find a better way in and like ease your way into finding that help that you need. Because honestly, that can be one of the big obstacles people face.
Yeah, BetterHelp is online therapy that offers video, phone, even live chat only therapy sessions so that you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy. You can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Right now, our listeners get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/comain. Again, that's betterhelp.com/comain. Ben, let's talk a little bit about the UFC 277 main event here. The rematch between current champion Juliana Pena and former champion Amanda Nunes. As I approach this fight, I really think that there's two questions that I want to have answered for myself. And one concerns each competitor in this bout. Obviously, the second round submission win for Juliana Pena over Amanda Nunes back at UFC 269 in December of 2021, where Pena took the title, was shocking in its result. And so here are my two questions. My question about Juliana Pena is whether or not she caught lightning in a bottle that night, or whether or not she's actually this good. Is she actually championship level good? My question about Amanda Nunes is she still about that life? Because I think if the answer to the question, to either of those questions, is yes, Juliana Pena just caught lightning in a bottle the last time, or yes, and or yes, Amanda Nunes is still about that life, we might be seeing Amanda Nunes get the title back on Saturday night. But if the answer to that question is no, Amanda Nunes, not really about that life anymore, then I could see Juliana Pena walking out this thing and still the champion. Where you come down on this?
Yeah, it does seem like the question that we ended up asking ourselves after that and headed into a rematch is, was this Juliana Pena being good or Amanda Nunes fucking up? Because yeah. If it was Amanda Nunes fucking up, either in terms of like preparation or that... You went into this thinking, all right, this will be an easy 5 minutes of work. Let me just go out there, put it on her and get out of here. And then the next thing you know, you're tired, basically, because she was looking kind of tired there. And you're going like, shit, this is harder work than I was mentally or physically prepared for. Then that does seem like the kind of thing that gets rectified. And we've seen this situation before in a few different championship pairings where... A champion comes in, maybe a dominant champion, maybe somebody who's been on top for a little while, and against somebody who is not expected to give them too tough a night of work, and they get surprised.
Yeah.
And then they go, all right, let's fucking get serious here. You know what? We're done playing. And they come back in for the rematch, and it's a completely different fight. You know, you think about George St. Pierre and Matt Serra, and not really thinking that George St. Pierre didn't take it serious or anything, but, you know, he gets surprised in that fight and he goes, okay, let's buckle down and go in there and you know you're the better fighter. Let's prove it. You can see it like in boxing fights where like Lennox Lewis and Haseem Rahman, where it's like, okay, you get that championship life and maybe it gets easier to get distracted or easy to get in there not fully 100% focused. And you pay for it. You have to go back, get your mind right. Rocky running on the beach with Apollo Creed, that kind of shit, to get back where you needed to be. And it's just a little bit, it serves as just a little reminder to you, you know, and then you're back on top before you know it. But then we've also seen the ones where, you know, remember Anderson Silva and Chris Weidman? Where it was like, you go out there the first time, Chris Weidman doing way better than you think. You're clowning around a little bit. You get knocked out and then comes back and, you know, grizzly leg break, but wasn't like he was doing a whole lot better in the rematch because it was like the Anderson Silva time had just kind of passed. We didn't necessarily know that that's what it was with the first loss there. It took a little bit more time for us to see that for what it was. It's tough to say because Amanda Nunes has been just dominating for a while now.
Yeah.
If you told me that she just kind of hit a point and, you know, either other people caught up, she lost a step here or there, faded just a little bit, and that proved to be enough for somebody to catch her from behind and then she couldn't get back, I guess I would believe that. And yet, there's another part of me that thinks that if she just goes in there with a better approach, a sounder game plan, not trying to just throw everything we got and take her head off and go home, that she should still be able to beat Juliana Pena.
Yeah, George St. Pierre, when he lost his fight to Matt Serra, all he did in order to rebound was to transform himself into the most dominant offensive wrestler the sport has ever seen. But it was also George St. Pierre who talked at length, kind of near the end of his run in the UFC, about how difficult it was to be the champion over a long period of time and how it felt like walking on the edge of a razor and how kind of both psychologically and physically exhausting it could be. And when you look at Amanda Nunes, like, she had won 12 fights in a row. She was this dominant two-division champion. She had a bunch of consecutive defenses of both the bantamweight and the featherweight title. And it, you know, there's a lot of ways in this sport, as we have talked about time and time again, for things to start going wrong for you. And when you're the champion, you are the game on everybody's schedule that they have circled on the calendar. You're going to get their best night, and you got to go out there and give your best night. And if you don't have your best night, you still got to be able to win. So I think there are a lot of potential explanations about how that first fight, or why that first fight, might have gone the way that it did. And, you know, above and beyond all that stuff, you got like an almost 35-year-old fighter in Amanda Nunes. She has a family now. She's married now. There was some camp upheaval in and around all this stuff. So, like, you don't have to look too far, I think, to find reasons why this first fight could have gone the way it did. And frankly, she looked kind of unprepared for the adversity when she found herself in it. You know, Juliana Pena came out there, kind of started sticking her with that jab, and Amanda Nunes started making that face that champions often make, which is, well, this isn't going my way so far, but I'm sure any moment now it will swing back and I will win in dominant fashion as I have so many times before.
Yeah. Soon the natural order will be restored. Don't even worry about it.
But as those jabs and those punches continue to mount and pile up, you can hear the UFC broadcast team kind of getting more and more excited about what they're witnessing. And then the fatigue, I think, starts to set in. And then Amanda Nunes ends up losing the title in, as I mentioned before, shocking fashion to Juliana Pena. So now I think we'll find out one way or another Saturday night in the main event of UFC 277 whether or not we're going to have a return to the status quo, or whether or not Juliana Pena marches forward as your ongoing champion here. Now, that is to say nothing or discount the abilities of Juliana Pena, because clearly she's a very, very good fighter. She came into this fight, their first fight, on the heels of a rear naked choke victory over Sarah McMahon. She had lost to Jermaine Durandamy and Valentina Shevchenko, but those are a couple of top-level fighters themselves. And aside from that, she had wins over Nico Montano, Kat Zingano, Jessica Ai, going back a while. So Juliana Pena is very good. I just think it was a surprise to see anyone go in there and do that to Amanda Nunes. And for Juliana Pena, maybe the million-dollar question is, can you do that again?
Yeah. Well, interesting. You remember UFC 269, when they met the first time, the odds closed with Juliana Pena as about a 7-1 underdog, Amanda Nunes as about a 10-1 or even as high as 11 or 12-1 some places favorite, which, damn. You know what I'm saying? This one right now, at the time of this recording, Juliana Pena about plus 240.
Yeah.
Amanda Nunes right around 3-1 favorite. And see, you might think, if you didn't know better, you'd hear, like, wait a minute. In the rematch where the person who lost comes in as a 3-1 favorite in the rematch, but then you think, okay, but it's down considerably from where we were. But it still says that odds makers are not ready to declare us living in the Juliana Pena era just yet.
Yeah. Those are, in fact, much better odds for Juliana Pena, but it's still got to be kind of a disquieting feeling to be the champion to roll into a fight when you're almost a 3-1 dog. But maybe, you know, you consider the opponent staring across the octagon from you, and you start to figure it out. The UFC has invested a season of The Ultimate Fighter into this thing. Juliana Pena and Amanda Nunes serving as coaches. I don't know how much that means anymore. Maybe almost nothing, but it's still, in theory at least, a promotional tool, a promotional chip that the UFC has to throw out there to get people interested in this fight, and they put it behind this one. So it feels like this is an immediate rematch, obviously, but it feels like there has been a little bit of water under the bridge, at least, since that first fight. If I had to put you on the spot and I had to tell you, or I had to say to you, Ben Foulkes, look in your crystal ball, shake some bones up in a bag and dump them out on the table and tell me what the spirits are telling you. Who wins this? What happens? How does this play out at UFC 277?
Well, I'm fully prepared to be made to look a fool again, but I cannot sit here and say that Juliana Pena is the better fighter than Amanda Nunes. I think that Amanda Nunes still, if she comes in there focused, ready, motivated, and there's every reason to think that she will be after losing that fight. And if you say that they did a season of the Ultimate Fighter around it, sure, I guess I have to take your word for it. If she has all her shit together, Amanda Nunes is fucking scary. And if she goes in there and fights like, you know, we're going to win this even if it takes all five rounds, rather than just throwing everything you got right and getting worn out by getting punched, jabbed to death early on, then I got to go Nunes. I just can't bet against her.
Yeah, I kind of think you're right, or I agree with you in any case. I guess I'm going to have it proved to me if we are turning the page, if we're leaving Amanda Nunes behind in this division. I'm going to have someone show it to me again before I start to believe it. And it's not a given. I certainly think Juliana Pena is capable, but at the same time, you know, given all of the things that we saw before from Amanda Nunes, I just have a hard time convincing myself, I guess, getting my mind brain to believe that that's where we are, unless we see it happen again. So it's kind of the way I'm leaning as well. Obviously, that's not the only interesting fight on this UFC 277 card. We've got an interim men's flyweight championship fight. Brandon Moreno and Kai Kara France about to do the damn thing. And of course, lurking in the background, we got our guy Davey Figgs, who found out the hard way, I guess, that the UFC would make an interim title out from under anybody, no matter who you are or how special you think you might be. Figueredo was out there. Even now, he's talking about getting this thing settled with whoever wins this interim title fight, once again becoming the undisputed UFC 125-pound champion. But he's also talking already about going to 135, finding out who is the champ there, and having a champ versus champion super fight, trying to become the champ multi-divisional champion, which, I don't know, man. I might just stay home and try to get this business taken care of in my own backyard before I head up there to a different division. But in any case, you got Brandon Moreno, the likable former flyweight champion, and Kai Kara France, who himself, just 29 years old, and Auckland, New Zealand fighter on a 3-fight win streak here, a guy who seems like he is quite likable. What do you see happening here? What's the thing for us to look forward to as we approach this interim fight?
I mean, honestly, it seems like a hell of a fight.
Yeah.
It seems like it'd be a whole lot of fun to watch. I kind of just, that's why I get annoyed at interim titles being thrown into stuff like this, because it's you asking me to go along with pretending this is something different than what it is. And if you would just sell it to me for what it is, I'd be pumped about that, because hard for me to see how these two guys don't go in there and have themselves a crackerjack. Now, I realize by saying that, I probably doom somebody's shoulder to just fall out the damn socket or something. But honestly, it's a tough one to call. Kai Kara France is looking like one of those guys where you're like, it might be his time. But then, you know, Brandon Moreno, that's a tough-ass dude, man. You get that guy. You can get that guy in some bad situations, but it's going to be tough to really get him out of there. You better pack a lunch. You fight that guy. I don't know, man. Like, the stuff we've seen from Brandon Moreno, one of the things that makes him fun is he's kind of can be all over the place, but he also seems like he has got it pretty dialed in recently It's tough for me to pick against him.
Yeah, I agree. Kai Kara France going off as the slight underdog here at plus 165. Brandon Moreno is minus 195. And again, it's just a guy we've seen compete at the championship level before, and we've seen be successful there. So it's a little bit easier to come down on his side of things here than it is Kai Kara France. But I agree with you, though. This shapes up as a super fun fight as, frankly, almost all the high-level flyweight fights at this point turn out to be pretty fun, though when Ben Fulks does give his stamp of approval.
Yeah.
I hope everybody's been doing their yoga, because recent history suggests, when we saw Brian Ortega shoulder pop out a joint, recent history suggests that that bad things could happen. So,
yeah.
Knock on wood. Hopefully everybody emerges from this thing in one piece and we can get a unification fight with Davis and Figueiredo on the books sooner rather than later. What about the guy Derek Lewis, the big fella, the heavyweight? You know, at one time he was out here knocking on the door of an interim title, obviously lost that fight to Ciryl Gane back in August of last year at UFC 265, came in and destroyed Chris Daukaus in the wake of that, but then lost to Tai Tuivasa at UFC 271, the fighter of destiny, frankly, that is Tai Tuivasa at this point. Derek Lewis does hold the UFC record for most knockout wins at 13 at this point, but as I mentioned, he is just 1-2 in his last three fights now. This feels like a little bit of a of an under-the-radar matchup for Derek Lewis going out there against Sergey Pavlovich, who is on a three-fight win streak, Marcelo Gomes, Maurice Green, and Shamil Abdurakhimov in a row for Sergey Pavlovich, 15-1 overall. So yet another one of these Russian fighters for the UFC who seems damn good. And I guess I have to ask the question, it begs the question, has Derek Lewis kind of reached the gatekeeper slash stepping stone portion of his career, or is he just like one big swing away from being the funnest guy in the division all over again?
The second one.
Yeah.
Let's not act like Derek Lewis hasn't been in this exact situation before. He has waffled back and forth between being the guy, the knockout artist that we suddenly get excited about, to like guy fighting whoever the tough ass Russian, Czech, Polish son of a bitch you have on the whoever shows up looking like he's been bald since he was 14 and he's got hair growing on tops of his shoulders. He's fought all those dudes, man. Like, Derek Lewis, they were just like, all right, Derek Lewis versus Shamil Abdurakhimov. And we were like, okay, Derek Lewis versus Marcin Tybura, Alexander Volkov, Blagoy Ivanov, Alexei Olenek. You know, he'd been here before. Derek Lewis will rise up, will be like, oh, holy shit, is Derek Lewis about to get to the absolute pinnacle based on throwing them things and a ground game that is just get up. We get excited. He'll lose one of the big ones. He falls back a little bit, quietly shows up, knocks out a few people, and the next thing we know, we're going, oh shit, we're excited about Derek Lewis again. He could do this until he's 50, just back and forth like this.
So he's got 13 years left on top, according to Ben Fulks. 37-year-old Derek Lewis going out there. Again, not old for a heavyweight, but old by the standards of some athletes. And, you know, I agree with you. He's the guy who could, he could be there as long as he wants. He's probably going to have a job in the UFC as long as he cares to have one. And, he could be going out to the county fair when he's 60 years old and pulling his trunks up over his belly button and knocking people out with a big old haymaker. I agree with that. I do wonder if maybe we've seen the last of Derek Lewis as a title contender, but again, you got heavyweight, man, like a couple of wins, couple of injuries to some other guys, and all of a sudden Derek Lewis is right back in the mix.
Yeah, when it's the Derek Lewis Tai Tuivasa rematch for the UFC, the undisputed UFC heavyweight title 9 months from now, we'll see what you have to say then.
Oh, I'll just take my money. That's what I'll have to say. Who do I give this money to? This pay-per-view also going down in Texas, by the way. So always good to have a Derek Lewis on the card, even though you're over there in Dallas this weekend. This other fight that I wanted to talk about before we wrap up, which we talked briefly about before we started recording, but at light heavyweight, an interesting matchup here, Anthony Smith against Magomed Ankalaev. And Ankalaev, 30 years old, on an absolute tear in the UFC right now. He's got 8 or 9 wins in a row here in the light heavyweight division. Recently defeated Volkan Oezdemir and Thiago Santos in back-to-back appearances. And, you know, is another one of these up-and-coming guys who at the moment feels like the heads know about him, but maybe he's a little bit under the radar. But at the same time, he gets this shot against Anthony Smith, who is a well-liked, well-known figure in this division, and would be a big leap forward for Magomed Ankalaev if he is able to get a win here over, the former title challenger and a really well-liked, kind of high-profile guy at this point in the 205-pound division in Anthony Smith.
Yeah, don't you think that's a tough night of work for Anthony Smith? As much as the UFC likes having him on commentary, is this one of those matchups where they're like, you know what, maybe we'll give you this fight as a way to encourage you to think about making the commentary thing your full-time gig?
Yeah, well, I think that they're trying to get eyeballs, obviously, on Kalaev, and a fight against Anthony Smith is the ticket to do that. Ankalaev knocking on the door right now, one of those top contender positions. The former champion Glover Teixeira is still your number one overall ranked contender for Jiří Procházka. Then you got Jan Blachowicz and Alexander Rakic sitting there right at 4, Magomed Ankalaev. So if he gets this win over Anthony Smith, you would figure that would probably be enough to put him in the conversation. Obviously, Jiří Procházka is talking about doing it again, brother, with Glover Teixeira, because apparently he wasn't that satisfied with his own performance in the fight during which he won the title. So he's going to go back and ask to do it over again. But after that, you know, a guy like Ankalaev will be right there. And odds makers like him by a wide margin against Anthony Smith. He's going off at minus 450, Anthony Smith at plus 360. So that would certainly be a big win for Ankalaev if he is able to get it.
Yeah.
All right, I think that's going to wrap it up for us this week. Thanks to everybody for listening. As I said, I'm on the road this week, so Patreon content will be a little bit trimmed down, but we've still got some fun stuff coming up over there if you want to check us out, patreon.com/comainevent. And of course, as of next week, we are back to our regularly scheduled programming. We'll be right here on Monday for the proper, free, and available to all, as always, to break down all of the stuff that happens at this UFC 277 fight card. And then we immediately start looking forward to Thiago Santos versus Jamal Hill, the fight night event going down back at the Apex in Las Vegas on August 6th. Thanks for listening, everybody. We will talk to you then. As for right now, though, we are done. We are through. We are out. The UFC calls you up and they're like, Ben, what are you doing July 30th? How do you feel about coming down to Texas to fight Magomed Ankalaev?
Oh, man.
Oh, are you okay? You don't sound great.
Oh, no. I think I got the monkey box.
Oh, no. You got the monkey box.
I'd really like to. Oh, man. Oh, yeah. No, that's the monkey box for sure. Damn. Shame. Too bad to miss out. You know what, though? I don't want to hear about Ankalaev's career being delayed by missing. So go ahead, give him another matchup. I'm ashamed to miss out on it, but you know, he deserves it. Give him another fight. I'll just take whoever you got next in line. Damn monkey pox.
Got the monkey pox. Wow.
Damn these monkey pox of mine.